There's the camera. Here I am, Walter Bosley, live on the Walter Bosley channel. And tonight we have another great episode of Killifornia with Todd Wood. And he's got special guests. Okay. Amy Iconospastic. Now she's got her own channel you guys are going to learn about. We've also got William Ramsey. So in a moment here, I'll bring them on and we'll get started. But I wanted to, let me see, is there anything I need to tell you guys about? Hold on a second. I got my phone cord getting in my way here, but that's okay. Once again, I think I told you guys, but my Napoleon article is out in the new, just released issue of World Explorer magazine. See that on the cover? Napoleon and the Great Pyramid. Yes, siree. This is my third time being published in this magazine. And it looks like a really great issue. I haven't read it yet myself. Aztlan and the Grand Canyon, The Mysteries of Early Korea, The Mystery of the Megalithic Jars, and my Napoleon article. So you can find this in Barnes & Noble on the magazine rack, or, as you should do, go to adventuresunlimitedpress.com and become a member, a subscriber, and you'll get the magazine, you'll get discounts, you'll get the catalog, just all sorts of good stuff. So go check out the WEX Club, World Explorer Club, at adventuresunlimitedpress.com. Get your hands on that magazine with my article on it. So I want to welcome everyone here tonight for another episode of Killifornia, as I said. And we have some folks in the live chat already. Tim Houston. Welcome, Tim. D. Dorothy Papineau. Johnny Sides here. Matthew Burns. And Rodney Stubbert, Jay Grinder, Ari Bavel, hello Ari, Paul the First, or Paul I, Crystal Fire, okay, Oregon Music Fan is here. So as people pile in, we're going to proceed with tonight's show. Now, everyone here is familiar with the Doors, okay? Even if you're not a graybeard in my generation, you're familiar with the Doors and their, I think, really great, you know, rock music. That rock and roll music them kids are listening to. And of course, you've heard of Aleister Crowley, particularly if you've, you know, watched this channel. And so tonight, we're going to discuss on Killifornia the possibility that Jim Morrison may have been a follower or devotee of Aleister Crowley, and the Doors included. And we're going to be getting into some other weird things in the Laurel Canyon music scene, which also means this book here will come up, Dave McGowan's Weird Scenes in the Canyon. You got to read this book. This is full of some amazing information, which we will be getting into. So without further ado, let us bring in our guests, Todd Wood and Amy Iconospastic. Welcome.
How you doing, guys? Hey. So glad to be back. Got Amy in the house.
Hello.
Got William Amy in the house.
Yeah, this is Amy's first time here, so I'm sure you've watched before, but now you're here. You get to be part of the weird nerdiness that is Killifornia on the Walter Bosley channel. And now we have William Ramsey. Welcome, William.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here. Thanks for the invite.
What's up, William?
So, hey, Todd. How are you?
Good.
Good.
Let me get over here, because as we know, the live chat knows that I do not pay attention to live chat while we're talking. So, folks, This is an interesting, very interesting topic tonight. So, Todd, I'm going to let you jump in and start us off.
Well, we thought this would be a good topic to start with. Just sort of an introduction into the whole weird scenes inside Laurel Canyon milieu. And for people who aren't like familiar with that, is a book written by Dave McAllen, and the synopsis of this book is that the legitimate anti-war movement was sort of co-opted by the hippie movement, and that a lot of the bands that you believed were sort of sprung up in Laurel Canyon, such as the Mamas and the Papas and the Doors and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young and what have you, you believe that they popped up organically. But the truth is much more sinister, that maybe the whole thing was orchestrated as a huge psyop.
Mm-hmm.
And the Doors is a great introduction to this whole thing, in my opinion. Would you say, Walter?
Yeah. I mean, that whole bit about, you know, their songs that we're all familiar with, most of them, I think, I'm not sure if it was all of them, but most of them, might've been all of them, were pre-written, before the band even formed, if I'm not mistaken. Right. Morrison.
Right.
Well, now I do want to say this though. Morrison, he was a poet, right? And, you know, I wonder if when he used the word songs, he was referring specifically to just the lyrics and then they did the music afterwards. But there's plenty of evidence to suggest that, you know, the music to some degree had been composed for them as well. Correct?
Yes. 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 In fact, I'm going to pass it over to Amy and she can start talking about Jim Morrison, the Doors and Laurel Canyon.
Excuse me, Todd, if you could do one thing, aim your camera down a little bit because we're basically getting the top. There we go. Now we can see.
Okay. People got a good look at my bald spot. That's important. That's important. My retreating hairline. See, what happens is I look in the mirror and then I hear these little screams and hair follicles just fall off. It's like they're committing suicide.
It's character building, Todd. It's character building.
It is.
Go ahead. Proceed.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Can you introduce us to the Doors in Laurel Canyon? Like, when did they form? And how did they meet? How did Jim Morrison meet the rest of the members? Or meet
film school
at UCLA?
Mm-hmm. Well, they want to make it seem like they met on a beach, but that's probably bullshit. Are we allowed to swear on this stream?
Yeah.
Okay, I just want to make sure because I have a potty mouth. Okay. Yeah.
That was 1965, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think 1965 on the beach, he met like his keyboard player.
The organist.
Ray Manzarek. Manzarek.
Zanin.
Yeah.
Film school. Now, an interesting factoid as a side note to meeting at the UCLA Film School, because everybody, I don't want anybody to be disappointed that we didn't at least mention some serial killers. The serial killer Rodney Alcala attended that same film school in 1968, as well as Luis Gonzalez, another killer that may have MKUltra ties, killed his girlfriend that same and mutilated her body that same year. He killed her to unleash his mother's spirit from his
girlfriend. I have a question. I didn't know that about Rodney Alcala, and now that I find out he went to UCLA Film School, how did he not get work as an executive in the motion picture industry?
I don't know. That's really interesting, considering his uncle, Bobby Bukur Alcala, who died.
That was a joke, Todd.
Oh, well,
being that he's a murderer and a criminal. Never mind. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I got you. But you know, people didn't know that in '68.
So. Okay. Well.
Yeah. Amy, you want to continue?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, Jim Morrison wasn't even a musician or a singer or anything.
Right.
He just was a poet. That was it. And they like recruited him. I mean,
wasn't it also that Manzarek asked him, "Can you sing?" And he said, "Fuck no." But it was like, "Let's do it."
Yeah, that's I think that's right. And you know, the funny thing is that movie makes you want to think that it's like they met on the beach, and you know, Zan Eric, what is
Manzarek? I think it's Manzarek.
Manzarek. Thank you, William. Mm. And that is such a cringeworthy part of that movie. I mean, oh my God. I could hardly stand it. It's exactly like the movie Step Brothers when John C. Reilly wanted Will Ferrell to start singing. I mean, it's exactly the same thing. It's utterly cringeworthy. And there's a lot about the Doors movie that the audience will find out in as this conversation progresses.
Yes.
That is inaccurate and incorrect.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The movie Stone took dramatic liberties big time.
He so sure did.
Continue, though. I won't interrupt anymore with humor.
You know, that's what Hollywood does.
Yeah.
Now,
what's interesting about Morrison and the secret kind of background is his dad was the guy involved in the Gulf of Tonkin incident in 1964. Right. He was like a high-level naval commander or something. Mm-hmm. But the whole Gulf of Tonkin,
it never happened.
Like it was all fiction. Like there wasn't even an encounter with a boat. They made everything.
Not only that, at this point in our history, the government are openly saying that it never happened, and that the whole thing was basically a false flag of some sort. I mean,
I'm saying, Todd, is that they just made everything up. Like there was actually no even false flag. They just said we were attacked.
That's the wrong term.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess they learned their lesson about, you know, with the USS Maine and the Spanish-American War. Why spend even money on the explosives? Just lie about it, right?
Right.
Good. It's interesting. There's actually a picture of Jim Morrison on the ship. What's the name of the ship again?
No, that picture's out there. There is a picture of him. I've seen it.
Yes.
With his dad.
Yeah, it's in the... the McGowan book. Here it is, right here. I got it. It is the oh my gosh, I should have known this. It's the USS Bonhomme Richard. I am a huge oh my God, I'm a huge fan of his, but I can't think of his name. John Paul Jones. I'm a huge fan of John Paul Jones, the naval officer, not the drummer. So, yeah, that picture was on the Bonhomme Richard in January of 1964. So
there you go. And I think the Gulf of Tonkin was August 1964. So he's on there the same year. This whole thing started off a disastrous war.
Right. I mean, thousands and thousands of people got murdered in that war, in the Vietnam War.
Was it 50,000
Americans, but we killed 3 million people there. All through Southeast Asia. So it was really a disaster for them. And it is interesting because Jim Morrison is on that bridge just 2 months after JFK gets assassinated, right?
Yeah.
And then the Gulf of Tonkin happens almost within the year. Like this.
Right. And then the next year is when the Doors born in 1965.
Wow. It's
you know what's interesting though? The issue I have with the photo is I don't know if that date is correct because look how young Morrison looks there in 64. And when did the Doors emerge at the Whiskey in 67?
And funny enough, Amy, you want to tell them who owned the Whiskey a Go-Go and how they got booked and Jim Morrison's background, like who he went to school with and like preschool?
It's Elmer Valentine owned the Whiskey a Go-Go.
Yeah, he's this disgraced, corrupt cop out of Chicago. And interestingly enough, the person booking the shows at the Whiskey a Go-Go was Gail Zappa. And the thing about Gail Zappa is she went to preschool with Jim Morrison in Virginia, and her parents were also part of the military-industrial complex.
Well, that was a big thing when I read McGowan's book. How many of these big stars? David Crosby was one of them. Zappa is another one. I mean, you name it. So many of them were the children of U.S. military officers, specifically intelligence officers in many cases. And, I mean, come on, do the math on that. The book has a lot more details on that. But, yeah, that's – so it really shouldn't be a surprise that, you know, that it's been suspected, put out there, that there was some type of PSYOP involved in the Laurel Canyon music scene, of course.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me one bit. I mean, just look at like Stephen Stills. We have to ask ourselves, like, what was he doing in El Salvador? Right? The guy was obviously doing some sort of like intelligent work.
Which one was it? Was it Stephen Stills? Who was it that said that they were doing that kind of stuff?
I don't know.
One of them in the book, McGowan, if I'm not mistaken, it's in the McGowan book, says that he was in Vietnam or gosh, I can't think. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, another interesting little factoid about Jim Morrison is that he actually went to the same Alexandria, Virginia high school as Mama Cass Elliott and John Phillips, who we'll discuss in a later show. And their potential connection, of course, to Manson and the Process Church of the Final Judgment. The real question here is, when did Jim Morrison go dark? As you know, when did he start getting into Crowley? When did the train get off the tracks, so to speak? Or maybe as a poet, maybe he was always into Jim Morrison. I bet William has a lot. Are always into Aleister Crowley. I bet William has something to say about that.
Well, I definitely have that picture you can show of him with the bust with the pyramidal hand gesture. You just have to click it in there, Walter. If you can see that on your side. Just have to add it to the show. So he's definitely has a bust of Crowley. I think that he was always kind of into the dark-sided stuff. So I think that's it. I could never... In my overview of him, I couldn't trace a lot of stuff. I know about his witch wife, and his witch wife is actually in the blood-seeking, drinking scene in the Doors film by Oliver Stone.
So right, and the wife herself is also in the wedding scene. She's like the high priestess in the wedding.
Cornelia
scene.
Is the high
priestess. I have to interject something here about the photo of the bust, the one where he's sitting there with the bust in front of him, and his hands are like this. Morrison,
can't you just draw that up, Walter? Just take your mouse over it and say "add to the show." It'll pop in.
No, it's not okay, doing I'll that. Here's the thing. I looked into that photo. As you can see, the way it's cropped, the rest of the band is not in the photo with him. But what it was a photo taken because they needed a promotional photo for a live album. Okay. Oh. And what that bust is actually a messed up, screwed up, broken, half broken bust of Ludwig von Beethoven.
Oh, interesting.
That's not Aleister Crowley. It's Beethoven.
I was always told that was Crowley.
When I looked it up, I saw other people said, "Oh, wait, isn't that Aleister Crowley?" And the source I saw that piped in was somebody who had been one of the roadies, and another person who had had a couple of people who have the album that has the photo on it. And anyway, multiple sources say that that's actually Ludwig von Beethoven.
Good to know.
Yeah.
Is Beethoven a Mason by any chance?
Oh. I think he had some kind of Illuminati connection, like his gravestone is full of symbolism.
Yeah,
apparently Mozart was a Mason, and that makes sense.
Right,
because
right.
Because he probably infiltrated all of Masonry. So that would make sense.
The magic flute was... fully Masonic. It was a totally Masonic.
Big time. That's what's famously Masonic with Mozart. Beethoven might have been. I mean, you know, back then, with the Illuminati having emerged in 1776, you know.
But yeah, so can he, and he was always, there were other instances of Morrison partaking in blood drinking like Crowley did. So there's other stories. There's multiple stories of him drinking blood.
Whoa. Tell us about those.
Well, there's one, there's from my book, Children of the Beast. It is groupie Pamela Day Barr. She was kind of a famous kind of rock groupie. She said that while Morrison was staying at the Chateau Marmont, which is kind of an infamous hotel in L.A., he spent a few wild nights with a buxom neighbor, instigating three ways and once waking up in a tangle of bloody sheets after they shared champagne glasses of each other's blood.
Right, right. Now, his wife, Patricia. Now, the interesting thing is, like, the one thing that the movie got wrong is she was not a Wiccan. She was not part of the Wiccan religion. She was actually a Celtic pagan. And anybody who's wondering, who's really deep into this subject, I will be pulling the thread and looking in to see if she has any ties to Greenfield Ranch, which, you know, also Leonard Lake is connected to Greenfield Ranch, and the Society for Creative Anachronism, which highly promotes intellectual pedophilia and pedophilia just in general. And of course, the Church of All Worlds, which is at Greenfield Ranch. So I will be pulling that thread if anybody is wondering.
Okay. Okay. Pamela DeBar, she legendary groupie from that era. I think she's the most famous of the groupies back then. And I looked at her, the one book she has where there's a chapter on Morrison, and of course, McGowan quotes the comment that, you know, about how much of a voracious reader he was. And the quote about, well, he read a lot about, what was it, incest and Satanism? That didn't seem as incendiary to me because, I mean, my gosh, if we were all guilty of the things we read about, all three of us would be in trouble.
Yeah, probably. You
know, no, right? I mean, I'm looking forward to reading your book, William.
Well, the Pamela's book, by the way, is called Rock Bottom, Dark Moments in Music Babylon. That's where I got that from.
Okay. Okay. That's probably her most interesting book, I would venture to say.
Yeah, she's an interesting character. I mean, she was definitely around. She bounced around. Okay. The other thing about, like, the Morrison, he references blood drinking as kind of a magical ritual in the song Peace Frog. So I think it is blood screams the pain as they chop off her fingers. Blood will be born in the birth of a nation. Blood is the rose of mysterious union. So that's like classic, you know, fusing together of union through blood. That's he's definitely referencing occultism or witchcraft.
Peace Frog was song I showed you.
Well, that makes sense because Crowley wrote that play about frogs where he crucifies a frog, right?
Right.
They sacrifice a frog.
So yeah, in the name of Jesus. The frog represents Jesus, right?
Yeah, and then frogs are like the food of snakes. And, you know, the devil's a serpent. So that makes sense.
Makes sense. Yeah, that ritual is called Cross of a Frog.
It's the Crowley ritual.
Okay, so we can, right there, are Morrison references to things, very specific things that Crowley wrote about. So clearly he was a reader of Crowley, a scholar of Crowley's writings. That's an interesting.
He also had kind of, you can see the shamanic nature of, like, you talk about original Celtic, but Morrison was interested in shamanism. He reenacted shamanism. He had some kind of connection to indigenous kind of people in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of flows through a lot of his music and outlook. Like, he was definitely trying to get into trance states during those live performances.
Right, right, right. You know, the interesting thing, just to take it back for a second, is that according to Paul Rothschild, the producer of The Doors, for most, I guess it was it most of their records? That they could not, like, the musicians in the band, they could not play their instruments.
Well, okay, I'd always heard, that, though.
Like, they were too, either too drunk or too high or too...
Okay. Maybe because of that, but my understanding was that Manzarek has always been a musician, the keyboardist.
Yeah.
And Dinsmore, he's the bassist, right?
No, that Dinsmore is the guitar player, I believe.
No, Dinsmore played drums.
Krieger
played guitar.
Krieger.
Manzarek was the keyboard.
Keyboardist, yeah. Krieger was a musician, but he wasn't known to have been on the music scene, right? It was like, okay, where'd he come from then?
You know?
But at least I can't speak to Dinsmore and Krieger, but my understanding is that Manzarek was, you know, a decent musician, but it wouldn't surprise me because, I mean, how many times was Morrison, did they have to jam for long periods of time because Morrison was inebriated and unable perform, right?
I don't know if Paul Rothschild was just referring to, like, the studio situation, because he is the producer.
Yeah.
That's what I thought. Maybe, like, they were just too high, too drunk.
Well, I mean, think of, you know, how many bands did the Wrecking Crew actually do the recordings? You know, they're the ones performing on the albums. We know that. There's been a lot of documentaries and books written about that, so... That wouldn't surprise me at all. But what interests me in this is let's go back to Morrison has written, you know, all these songs, at least the lyrics. They emerge on the scene. Oh, here's a band called The Doors. They emerge on the scene. And there was something pointed out that I was reading that, someone pointed out that they maintained their lineup through their whole history, which if you look at the other bands, that changed a lot, but The Doors always, you know, were those four guys. Mm-hmm. And so in the milieu of all these performers who were the kids of military intelligence guys, what would you say was their intended contribution in a psyop?
Well, the whole hippie thing, right? The whole hippie thing is about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It's all about self-indulgence. Yeah. Compared to, like, the anti-war movement, it was wagging their finger at the Vietnam War, right? So they the government, the psyop is, they turn the scales. They turn the tables on the counterculture, right? And culture is downstream from politics.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, and just the fact that some of these bands, like, it took no time at all. Magazines started talking about them. And then you have the whole thing, like, even if it's The Doors' first band, our first show, you know, you still had Vito and the Freaks coming in and playing and dancing. Because there's all these girls dancing, now you got guys coming in to dance with the girls, right?
Yeah.
So that's like an instant crowd.
Well, when you now jumping back over to the Crowley connection, and William, you might know this or have some input on this. I'm curious who might have introduced, say, Morrison to Crowley and others to this stuff within a context of a psyop, because I think of Sidney Gottlieb of the CIA MK Ultra program, the guy who was into all this occult stuff. And if CIA and the MK Ultra guys had anything to do with this psyop, I could see Gottlieb being the one wanting to inject Crowleyism into all this. What do you guys think about that?
I think they were change agents. I think The Doors knew it. I think that the Beatles knew it. I think the Rolling Stones knew it. So who's behind these guys? There's all kinds of weird stuff with the Dead too. Like, they're attached to, like, intel So whether mm-hmm. there's an intel, like some of this music, I think I've heard arguments that a lot of the Beatles music was not written by them. Mm-hmm. And those are mm-hmm. all probably sealed up by like agreements or contracts or things like that. So whether the Doors have had that happen to them is a good question. But I can read you a quote from Manzarek mm-hmm. that is, I think, is very telling in a lot of ways, because it includes a lot of kind of change issues, like what do you call it? It would be like full on 1,000-year change, you know, aeonic change. This is what he said about it. This is a quote from one of his books. The reason for the Doors, the raison d'etre for the Doors, was making music to plug yourself into the vibrations of the planet. Harmonize your inner vibration with the vibration of the audience. The human beings vibrating in harmony together. It's like a pagan. It's like some sort of mystical Christ. The release of the Kundalini power expanding in your body and coiling upwards. The Aquarian age in which we'll finally begin to merge all the religions and sciences and arts and whatnots, and we will realize that we are gods. Jim Morrison was a god unto himself. I'm a god unto myself. We are all gods unto ourselves. So put it outside of yourself. To put it outside of yourself is seeking a false messiah. That's Masonic. That's the end of the 2,000 years of culture and the religion we are involved in now. So,
yeah,
they're getting rid of 2,000 years of Christianity to start a new kind of world view.
Okay, yeah, to bring it into that, what people, some people would say the music industry in particular, it is really moving that forward even more, that idea. With some of the things they do. I mean, you could do a whole show on what goes on at the Grammy Awards with all this talk of rituals and some of the musical performances that are very ritualistic in theme. And so, you know, looks like the music industry has never stopped doing what Manzarek has been saying there.
I would agree with that. I mean, they're all part of that same process, I think.
What was that, Amy?
It's a way for them to live forever. If you think about it, like Aleister Crowley just wanted to, like, he wanted to create this religion that would last. And so that he doesn't have to die, you know? And it's like, yeah, all these musicians, like they're essentially doing the same thing because we're still listening to them. So.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah. Pop culture became this, this different thing in the 60s than it had ever been before in this country, you know,
right.
And by extension, the West.
Well, I mean, plus at that time, that, you know, with a song like The End, right? And one of Walter and my favorite movies, and one day we'll do a video that's an analysis of Apocalypse Now. The opening scene is The End. And then at the end, the closing scene when Willard is, you know, I won't spoil anything. The end plays again right where it leaves off at, from the beginning of the film.
Yeah, yeah. And well, go ahead. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
To me, that song, what the song represents, is the end of our innocence. It's the end of America's innocence, because the Vietnam War. Like what William was talking about, it just, you know, there was no reason for us to be involved with that war at all. At all. And it's not like World War II, where we had
Pearl Harbor. Clear. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. They had to make up something for us to go to war.
Well, and let's not forget Korea. Korea was really the first war we had where our military-industrial complex was calling the shots. That was where they tested the model that they used in Vietnam in Korea. Mm-hmm. And this whole idea of the policemen of the world crap.
Yeah.
You know, so so let's get into what, and I know, William, you have a lot of this info. The evidence for the Doors and Jim Morrison being, you know, using these satanic themes and really presenting and pushing satanic themes and being into this stuff. What is out there that you know, demonstrates that, illuminates that for us.
Well, he, I mean, he supposedly met Satan in Venice. Do you ever hear that story?
Like, no.
Yeah, he said that. He says, I left school and went down to the beach to live. I slept on a roof. At night, the moon became a woman's face. I met the spirit of music and appearance of the devil on a Venice canal running. I saw Satan or Satyr moving beside me, a fleshy shadow of my secret mind. So I saw some kind of phantasm or something.
That was I wonder how drunk or high he was when he saw that.
Who knows? Probably high. I don't know if he ever was not drunk. He was a total day drinker too. But
yeah, he was. He was. Yeah.
I think that was it. He was just dark-sided. He was interested in that kind of dark-sided stuff. How much of his occultism, where he learned it from, I'm just not aware of that. I'd have to go back and read a lot more of his kind of biographies and things like that. But
yeah, because
Sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I kind of wonder how much he learned from from Patricia.
True. Good point. Good point. And, you know, the fact that he was a voracious reader and, you know, on the other hand, with all this stuff, it could be that because he was a curious intellectual type and because of the times where everything was, you know, careening into a social chaos and, you know, everybody was exploring to find themselves. And perhaps because, as you said, he's dark-sided in kind of a Byron-esque way, of course, you know, I wonder how much of this was effect, you know, an effect of his intellectual stimulations. So he was expressing these kinds of things, and that's as far as it went, you know. But the story about the drinking of blood, that's a little bit farther than just poetic meanderings. Indeed. Is there anything else?
There's other pictures of him. I sent some of them to Todd where he's like doing the classic kind of Hollywood one eye themes, and goat on the stage.
I'll send those to you, Walter. I'm sorry I didn't.
Sheep.
He would have like the death's head hat.
Wow.
He seemed to know, like somebody said that maybe his beard was like associated with the process, so he might have been close to them. The process was in Venice at the time, is my understanding.
Right.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, Peace Frog says that blood on the streets in the town of New Haven, blood stains the roots in the palm trees of Venice. So
right,
he like pops like two American cult cities with stolen bones. And
let me just add something too. According to Maury Terry's book, The Ultimate Evil, the informant told Maury that Manson II was living in Venice.
Wow.
The person who orchestrated the murder of Arliss Perry, which we talked about last time when William was on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that there was a suspicious death that was tied to Manson and the family that was never really confirmed, but it was a strange death of a guy by the name of Haupt, Haupt, in Venice. And they just, you know, it was like one of those mysterious deaths that was around the Manson family, much like their lawyer who died in a river, like a smiley face killings death, like mysteriously shows up in a river. So Venice was a strange place back then. It's much different now. It's gentrified. But
what do we know about Manzarek, Dinsmore, and Krieger's pasts?
That's a good question. I don't know much about it. I don't know much about them.
And I'm trying to remember what at least McGowan said.
I think Manzarek has passed away, and I believe Krieger and Dinsmore are still around.
Yeah. I know Manzarek was a huge fan of UCLA basketball because he was in a documentary about the UCLA had that streak.
Right.
In the 60s and 70s where they're just winning championship after championship.
Now, but were their parents, either one of their parents, their father's military guys at all?
That would not surprise me one bit if they were. I don't know off the top of my head. William, do you know?
That they're in the military. He's the Manzarek. It says here, according to his Wikipedia, he's born in Chicago, Illinois, to Polish parents. So they don't seem to have anything.
Hmm.
He actually was briefly enrolled at UCLA School of Law.
Well, and William, you probably know this. There are spooks around the legal profession. So that's interesting. He might have been
recruited. They're recruited.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Spotted, yeah. So there we go. I mean, that could be. Now, here's the interesting thing. If you looked into his parents, okay, from Poland, is what that seems to say. If they had come over during either World War II or the early years of the Cold War, they might have been sources to some degree of the intelligence community, which would then have put their son on the scope for the spooks, you know, who could have. Folks, this is all, you know, speculation right here, but with the circumstances, you know, we're trying to figure this out. That's the fact that you said his parents were from Poland and he went to law school at one time. I see spooks possibly in his life before the Doors. So that kind of lends to what we're talking about here. And of course, Krieger and Dinsmore wouldn't have to have had a connection like that. If Morrison and Manzarek were the ones who were directly spook connected, that would have been enough, you know.
Right. Amy, what was I going to ask you? Like, what would you tell us about like the death of Jim Morrison?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing it has in common, maybe that the ship evolved.
He died the same time that his dad. I don't know.
His dad gave the keynote speech. Yeah,
he gave a speech about the Vietnam War or something like that.
You got your notes
here.
I got my notes too. He basically gave the speech the same day that Jim Morrison died. They retired the boat that was involved in the Gulf of Tonkin incident.
Yeah, allegedly involved, right?
Right.
There was all kinds
of strange stuff going on during that time. USS Liberty, all the assassinations. It's really incredible. The '60s probably influenced the music. Because there was so much murder and death and assassinations and mind
control
and things like that. So
yeah.
It's probably why there was so much high strangeness in all these bands. And I mean, some of those guys were really elites. I think Crosby is really a Van Cortlandt, which is an old kind of East Coast WASP family. And there's actually a park in the boroughs of New York City called Van Cortlandt Park where there was some process connections or I think one of these teachers or something was taken there and murdered ritually or something
Right. And that's close to Untermyer, isn't it?
Yeah. It's just south. It's called Van Cortlandt Park. Yeah, that's Crosby. Mm-hmm.
Now, Amy might know something about this. I saw this emerge 2 days ago, which was April 1st. But the story going around social media about Morrison's alive, he was found alive. And there's a lot of people, I think, that aren't realizing that story was likely from what I'm gathering, an April Fool's joke. But I do recall that, there is the historical poet Rimbaud who faked his own death. And, so stories of Morrison faking his own death have been around for a long time. If I'm not mistaken, the film Eddie and the Cruisers was inspired by the Morrison story. If you haven't seen that movie, it's from the 80s. So spoiler alert.
Pretty good.
It is. It's a good film. But, you know, Amy, have you heard anything that could be taken seriously or considered about maybe Morrison, you know, is alive or didn't die when they said he did?
I mean, maybe they put him in witness protection or something. I mean, I don't know. Like, people would believe anybody would, like, anybody that has some sort of alcohol or drug problem, it's really easy for people to believe that they would overdose. So, you know, and it's the same thing. I'm a huge fan of Tupac, And so when they took him out, you know, he spoke out about the media. He spoke out about what they were actually doing with the black race, trying to like manipulate them and thinking that it was like, you know, white people that were, you know, out to get him all the time.
Yeah.
And so that's what they do. That like they control, like if anybody has talent, they just use them until they don't need them anymore. Yeah. Essentially.
Yeah. Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh no, but I mean, I was gonna ask like how many Doors albums there were, like three.
I don't
think there weren't that many.
Career. Like that's a pretty short-lived musical career.
Yeah, and no doubt. Well, what I like what you said about witness protection, where my mind was going is that if Morrison had intelligence agency connections, you know, they can pull off and provide the best witness protection program of anyone. And it would have been very easy for them to pull that off with him. So I've never dismissed out of hand the idea that Morrison faked his death. I think it would be like him because I think him going to Paris to begin with, wasn't that kind of screw it. I'm going to Paris. You know, it was just like his time on the scene was done. So off he went to Paris.
The mission has ended.
Yeah.
They made six albums while Morrison was supposedly still alive. From 67 to 71 was six albums. Six. To the Wikipedia.
I don't know why I thought it was three. But yeah, I mean, he had his like little heyday. And then once that was over, it's like, okay, we don't need you anymore. Bye-bye.
Right.
You know,
and then he goes to Paris and then they decide, you know, okay, we're going to fake your death. You can go live on the island with Elvis and Tupac and all of them. Right. Yeah.
Join the 27 Club and
the 27 Club. There you go.
Right. Right. Yeah. And well, they just recently, they recently arrested the guy who claimed to have killed Tupac.
Oh yes.
That's right. Yeah. That's correct.
Right. You know, going back to the photo of Morrison, you know, it's supposed to be on the Bonhomme Richard, which was named after John Paul Jones' famous ship, the I've Not Yet Begun to Fight Battle off of Flamborough Head. Great story. I got to do a show on that. Anyway, here's what's interesting. Morrison goes to Paris, where he allegedly dies. A lot of Americans don't know this, but John Paul Jones had retired to Paris and died there. And, he was destitute, but somebody there in Paris thought enough to bury him or to encase him in a lead box filled with alcohol because they assumed, you know what? The United States is going to want his remains someday. And there those remains sat, okay, until in a basement of a Paris house until Teddy Roosevelt was president and Charles Bonaparte, the American-born grandnephew of Napoleon Bonaparte, was Secretary of the Navy, and they brought with great fanfare the remains of John Paul Jones back to America and, of course, interred him where he is now at the U.S. Naval Academy in a beautiful crypt.
Amazing. That's a great story.
Right? And it's interesting that, you know, Morrison, his dad was Navy, he's on the Bonhomme Richard, and then he goes to Paris to die. He's poetic enough that I wonder if he was a fan, of John Paul Jones, the naval officer.
Wasn't
anyway.
John Paul Jones famous for raiding the UK? Like he would take his boat.
He was a master. He would raid the coast of England, and they caught him off of Scotland, off of what's called Flamborough Head, which is an entry into one of the rivers or whatever. And his escort took off scared. So he was left alone, he and his crew, with the Bonhomme Richard to face the British. And the Serapis came at him, and they famously were going at it with the broadsides. And the Bonhomme Richard was being obliterated and was beginning to sink. And the British captain called out, said, "Hey, do you want to strike your colors and surrender?" And that's when Jones did his famous line, "Strike my colors, I'll be damned. I've not yet begun to fight." And then he orders his crew to get out the grappling hooks, and they use the lines to bring the sinking Bonhomme Richard right tight up against the Serapis. He breaks out the sabers and the pistols. His crew goes onto the Serapis, beats the ass of the British crew and they capture the Serapis. I mean, that's one of the most beautiful stories in American history. It's just, I love that kind of bravado. And that's the famous, I've not yet begun to fight, you know, the whole story. But yeah, he was quite an interesting quite an interesting guy. Anyway, that was a huge digression. Sorry about that. Let's get back to Morrison, story. The Doors, and you know, their involvement with Satanism and Crowleyism.
Right, right. What was I going to say? You know, the interesting thing about just about the Laurel Canyon scene in general is it seemed like a lot of them were kind of into the whole Crowleyism thing.
Yeah.
They're
because at least of the personal freedom and all that. Of
Aleister Crowley, you know?
Yeah, sex and drugs and all that stuff.
Right. Yeah. It was all about they certainly, part of a PSYOP or not, they all certainly enjoyed the fruits of that kind of personal freedom. You know, a lot of people in America were, you know, for how many years before they, of course, unleashed upon us the Manson family and consciously destroyed in the Summer of Love the whole hippie meme, as it were, right?
Right, so, right.
Yeah, they put the kibosh on that movie. Desires.
What's that, Amy?
It exploits our carnal desires.
Yeah. Yeah. The easiest thing to exploit in the human psyche, wouldn't you say? Is the carnality, the base desires. That's the easy way to go at someone. If you want to compromise.
Freedom and yes. Liberty.
Yeah, yeah. It's all, you know, the sexual revolution and all of that. What year did Morrison go to Paris?
70 or 71? Was it?
Oh, 71.
I think he supposedly died in 71, I think.
Okay.
July 3rd, 1971.
July 3rd. Interesting choice.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Just a day off.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder, you know, that's kind of interesting.
I wonder when he left, what would the time frame between when he left and when he died? I guess he said he left in March and died in July. Left L.A. in March.
So he wasn't in Paris very long when he died, is that right?
No, not very long.
That sounds, I don't think he was, actually.
4 months.
If memory serves, he wasn't there. It had to be like, it couldn't have been a year. It had to be something like 3 or 4 months or like,
yeah,
you know.
I think you're right.
Now, when was Manson captured?
In the Manson was captured in 69, August 8th. No, it was after that because Susan Atkins is the one who kind of spilled the beans. They caught him in a, was it a cupboard?
Yeah, he was in a cabinet. A little cabinet, but
yeah,
but
he's at that canyon where the devil house is.
Cielo Canyon.
No, not Cielo.
Topanga.
Yeah, that's Topanga? It. Topanga.
Okay. Yeah, Topanga there's a lot of interesting UFO activity in Topanga over the years too. That's kind of interesting. Now, when was the trial?
For Manson? You know,
that Bulio.
Well, that took place all through 1970.
All through the year 1970.
Yeah.
Okay. And Morrison leaves for Paris in spring of 71. I mean, one could say, well, that was the end of the freedom loving hippie era, you know, there in LA. So why stick around? But then one could also say, like we said a moment ago, mission accomplished, you know, time to disperse. I wonder how many of the others that we've talked about, when did they start leaving Laurel Canyon? Like Zappa and Crosby and Stills and them.
Right.
That's a good question.
I know Zappa went back to Washington because he had a pretty good little career. As a political career,
Oh, in the '80s. Yeah. When all that stuff about the naughty lyrics and, you know, mm-hmm. the Tipper Gore and all that, that was that late '80s or early '90s actually.
Right. Now, the funny thing about
early '90s,
the funny thing about Zappa is like Zappa hated the counterculture.
Yeah, he did.
He hated them. It's like Anton LaVey. Anton LaVey also hated the counterculture.
Because he was authoritarian. Yeah. So why would he do drugs? Because that would alter his state of mind. He couldn't control anything.
Right? Yeah, he didn't like drugs. He would let them come to the log cabin and party and do all that, but he wouldn't do it himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the reason why they pushed all the drugs was so they could push the police state. You know, because shortly after that was the war on drugs.
Yeah, you know? That's true. So. That's true. Which was never fought the way it should have been fought if they were really wanting to do something about it. And we know why, because the drug trade was part of, you know, if you, is it Gary Webb? Was he the unfortunate guy? Yeah. You know, if you read his stuff, the drug trade had always been how the CIA and the military industrial complex, you know, part of how they were doing business. And that, and actually goes back to Phoenix in Vietnam, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Right.
Golden Triangle, all that stuff,
Which actually goes back to the British Empire in China. They're the ones who started the
opium wars.
The drug trade and all that, you know. So, my friends, the British.
They're legalizing pot right now. Have you noticed that?
Like, what's that?
They're legalizing marijuana, like, all over the country. And, like,
yeah,
a lot of people are going to mental institutions because they're using this government weed.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Yeah, you know, as my viewers know, I'm a Air Force officer, reserve, inactive, came off active duty years ago, and a former federal agent. And, you know, I never smoked weed, never did any of that. But since I went through cancer treatment, I do, gummies every night, you know, so I can sleep better. Like, what's that?
You like it? Do you enjoy it?
Yeah, I sleep straight through the night, and you know, my kid and her friends, and my son too, when he's out, you know, everybody laughs at me because when it hits, I go, "Oh, here comes balloon head." I'm like, "Oh wow, altered states," and
it's probably probably the healthiest sleeping aid you could take.
Right, that's what I understand.
Your body should just. It's part of the, what do they call it? There's a certain system in your,
it cancels out the REM cycle too. So if you have PTSD that, you know, you have nightmares, it really helps with that.
Guys, I'll be right back. You guys speak amongst yourselves.
Okay, yeah, but let's all hide. A good question. There's a different connections between Morrison. Like, it's probably have to go through his biographies, but I know he was hanging out with those guys in New York City. Was the Andy Warhol, and there was like a whole crew of really interesting.
The Velvet Underground, right?
Yeah, so that heroin chic was a big thing at that time, so he was part of that. They say that he died, his drug dealer died, and his girlfriend at the time, not Keneally, but somebody else died, all from heroin consumption. It was China White. He was like supposed to be super pure. That's the argument if he died at all, but that's supposedly how he OD'd. But I think the drug dealer they had at the time in Paris definitely OD'd on that. So there's a lot of other questions about Morrison. Maybe it's a whole nother show, but like, who's he's hanging out with the kind of artistic cognoscenti, whatever, you know, glitterati type characters. So I wonder where he learned his stuff. Like, who was imparting this stuff to him? Was it reading?
Yeah. You know, I wonder, you know, he had kind of a, from what I understand, not the best relationship with his parents, right? Because his dad, being a military officer, military guy.
He said they were dead.
He what?
He said they were dead.
Yeah, he said they were dead at one point. And his mom, from what I understand, he really did not like his mom. He thought of her. Oh, what's the thing about, you know, the issue with the incest? Pamela DeBar said that he liked to read up on that. And then there's the famous performance, I think it was in Madison Square Garden, where his mother was present, and he makes the comment,
Dad, I want to kill you. The what
is it? Oh, yeah. the middle part of the end.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The killer woke before dawn. He put his boots on. He chose a face from the ancient gallery and he walked on down the hall. First, he paid a visit to his brother. Then he paid a visit to his sister. And yeah, it's the classic Oedipus complex.
Yeah, because he says, yeah. You know, mom or mother or something, I want to
fuck you. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was
use their music to explain like things that happened to them as a kid.
Right? Right? Yeah. So. Yeah. So you got to wonder what the heck was going on there. I mean, was it just because she was supposed to be such a ball buster, you know, to his dad that this was an angry way for him to, you know, lash out at her, maybe embarrass her, or was there really some Oedipal, you know, incestuous thing going on in his head? Because remember, again, he's a poet. Certainly he was into Byron. And we know that Byron had a thing for, what was it, a half-sister, right?
Byron, I thought it was a cousin.
Was it a cousin? Well, Edgar Allan Poe, I believe it was an underage cousin. I think Byron, maybe it was a cousin. Yeah, because you know what? I took that situation and applied it and that aspect into a novel I did where the main character ends up with his half-sister. And it was inspired by the Byron thing, which Byron, you're right, it was a cousin, which, mm-hmm. you know, doesn't seem as pearl-clutching to us in our times as it would have then. But then again, shouldn't it have then? Because people married their cousins all the time. So now I've come full circle. Why was that ever shocking that Byron was into his cousin, you know?
You don't want to be with your first cousin, right?
Well, you know, the state of California.
Maybe if it's like your 25th cousin, 8 times removed or something.
Well, in the state of California, Washington State, New York, I think there's about like 7 or 8 states you can marry your first cousins. So you can marry them despite whatever potential blood medical issues there might come of that. And that's just setting aside the, you know, the weirdness of it. Most of us think of our first cousins as siblings, right? If we've spent time around them, you know, I think everywhere you can marry like a second, third and, you know, on cousin, but it's kind of weird to people, but not nearly as weird as the Oedipus or the Electra complex. So, you know, I just, all of this makes me wonder, what went on in Morrison's childhood and in his young teens? Did all this stuff he was into merely come from his intellectual interests and what he read, or, you know, what the heck was in the mix here? And to what extent did he talk about Crowley? Morrison?
I don't know. William? Like, I thought I was under the impression that idol was Crowley until you said it wasn't. Like, I read it from somewhere else, so I'm pretty surprised. I don't know. Like, I'd have to go back through and read through his stuff. I don't really have that long of a part of section on Morrison in my book. I have like 3 or 4 pages. But he's definitely an occultist blood drinker, which is very Crowleyan. And
yeah, well, tell us more. Tell us more about your book that maybe things we haven't covered today.
Well, I mean, what I was doing is in Children of the Beast is tracing Crowley's impact on the 20th century. And his impact isn't merely cultural, it's political as well. So there's a lot of political figures and political events that have really strong Crowley connections, like 9/11. All the numerology of 9/11 can be traced back through Crowley. 1193, 77, 174.
Yeah, that stuff's mind-blowing. That really, wow.
Also, like L. Ron Hubbard. I mean, you've got all the Ian Fleming knew him and was in communication, right? The guy who did Bond. So his
first
Monte Carlo, Process Church, Scientology. The founder of the gay movement, Harry Hay. John Carradine was a member of the OTO, one of the father of the four Carradine brothers.
That one blew my mind. Yeah. It's like, whoa, John Carradine, really? Now, you mentioned L. Ron Hubbard. I'm curious about Elbert Hubbard, his uncle. I have a couple of books of his. He died on the Lusitania, which, of course, to me, there's all sorts of weirdness. Weirdness connected to Lusitania.
Highest weirdness. Totally strange.
It right?
involves
yeah.
Crowley, too. Involves Crowley. Crowley came
oh, that's right. States. Yeah.
Crowley of course. Came to the United States on the Lusitania.
Yeah. Right. It, disturbing. Now, is there anything you're aware of where L. Ron is concerned that maybe Elbert Hubbard might have given us clues to, or was Elbert just not involved with anything that
Ron... I don't recall coming across Elbert Hubbard. I wasn't aware with him, of him, but L. Ron Hubbard's son said that his father was definitely interested in Crowley and used to see him kind of going through his stuff in his speeches and some of the very early parts of Scientology. He's clearly referencing in recorded conversations. Aleister Crowley calls him the Great Beast, 666. Mm-hmm. Interesting guy, magician. So Hubbard was very aware of that and very aware, had to have been very aware because he was very associated, if not part of the Agape Lodge in Pasadena with
right. This is just a little sample of our next thing we're doing.
Oh, okay. So you guys are going to get into this on the next California or the next
the pre-record.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. That'll be good. That'll be good. You guys are going to have to, wait until that's ready to hear that stuff. So, we'll keep everyone apprised of how soon that's going to be available. And, so is there anything that, we didn't cover yet in for today that you guys wanted to, William or Amy wanted to talk about or bring up?
Not me. I know.
We're all covered.
We should have got those pictures together and put together a little slideshow. It would have been interesting.
What we can do is, Todd, you can send them to me and we can attach them somehow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, well, this is the point of the show where we go to the live chat and take questions. If you guys, you good for another half hour, William and
sure,
Amy?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. Alrighty, folks. Remember, all caps, if you want us to acknowledge the comment or answer the question, all caps, because there's a lot of side conversations that go on in live chats, and we want to know that you're addressing us. Any questions for the guests? Todd, Amy, or William on Aleister Crowley and the music scene of the 60s, Jim Morrison, The Doors.
Before we get started on that, I'd like to remind everybody to please hit the like button and subscribe. If you like what you're hearing here, hit that like and hit subscribe. Very important.
Yes, yes, indeed. If the Laurel Canyon music scene and all the musical product that came out of that was part of a psyop, we have to ask ourselves, what the hell was disco?
Oh, yeah. Disco was pretty terrible.
Sex.
Thank you. I think Amy hit the nail on the head. It doesn't mean that disco was not a psyop. In fact, disco very well could have been another psyop. I think that's what
disco led in.
Kind of half
disco led into house music.
What's yeah, right? And yeah, house music. Early, oh boy. Trance. Those early
drum beats that they would sample all came from disco.
Yeah, okay. Johnny Sides.
The music.
Go ahead, Amy.
I'm sorry. The music correlates with the political events of the time, they're pushing like women's rights and everything, and they're pushing like homosexuality. And then, the music is going to be the first thing to do that, like what Todd was saying before, like politics is downstream from culture. And so it makes perfect sense why all these political decisions, like major political decisions occurred in the 70s after this whole, the left took over the culture war, which wasn't hard for them. Mm-hmm. Not at all.
Right.
There's no pushback.
Right. let me see. I hate when this just starts piling up here. Johnny Side says, I have read so much on Jim Morrison, and I think this is a huge reach in regards to Jim Morrison and any Crowley connections. Okay, that's fair enough. However, I think particular set of verse that was quoted about the blood and the fingers and things like that, circumstantial though it may be, and the thing about the frog and all of that, you know, apparently we do find this in Crowley's writings. So there's a reference at the very least. It appears that Morrison did reference Crowley right. writings.
And anybody who's a student of the occult, which it appears that Jim Morrison to some extent was, there's no way to avoid Crowley. If you're studying the occult, at some point you're going to hit that Crowley iceberg.
Right, of course, of course. Yeah. But what we have to remember in all fairness is, you know, just like us three here, we are scholars and students, you know, as far as scholarly pursuits, of some pretty dark, rotten things. It does not mean that we would condone those things or participate in them, you know, no matter what the artistic expression, just like the people who created the TV series Dexter, for example. I doubt any of them. I hope none of them are serial killers, but I guess one would never know. Johnny Side again, the rest of the Laurel Canyon crew with MK Ultra. Yes. Read the Laurel Canyon book. Okay. Yeah. I want to add to that. I totally am on board with there was some type of military industrial complex intelligence community connection to all these people. I mean, yeah, I agree. You don't have that many people being, you know, having fathers who are in that business and just dismiss that. You cannot, you know.
Right. And just the machine that was behind the music, the way that they like instantly like be promoted in magazines, they'd instantly go on Johnny Carson American Bandstand or whatever.
Think it takes forever
for an actual band to like get started.
Right. And think of that movie studio, that secret movie studio that several stars had been called in to make movies that were produced by the U.S. government, which the public to this day has never seen. And that facility was right there, you know, in that area. So if movies, why not music, you know?
Right. And then remember, we were talking about the Air Force and MK Ultra. That was an Air Force base.
Yeah. Yeah, so there you go. 5DRG asks, wasn't Jim Morrison supposed to have said he had murdered someone? I'm not familiar with that. William or...
I don't know that. I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. Jay Grinder, Disco was selling cocaine. That was a part of it. Yeah. Absolutely. I would agree there. Rodney Stubbard asks, does anyone know anything about Denny Doherty of the Mamas and the Papas?
I know a lot about Papa Cass, and I know a lot about John Phillips. I don't know as much about Donnie Doherty as I should.
Yeah. One project says all music is psyop. There's wisdom in that, yes. Johnny Sy, fair. Walter Morrison is a hero of mine, and I like Crowley, so I may be biased. Yeah, I hear you.
At least you can admit it.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Hey,
we can all disagree. And there's nothing wrong with us disagreeing or anything like that. We're just people with opinions.
You're nowhere near as bad as Zappa fans. Zappa fans wouldn't even listen to this.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to reading William's book, Child of the Beast, because I do need to, you know, learn what I don't know about Crowley so that I can, you know, as always, like you said, we all decide for ourselves.
His ideas are seeded all through our culture. Alan Moore, David Bowie, Ozzy Osbourne.
Absolutely. That is true. That is true. Rodney Stubbert says, I've read a ton about Morrison too. I think it's a reach. Okay. Okay. Fair enough. D.E. Saccone, who in that same era did not die, but you feel were heavily influenced by Crowley? Anyone else that you would point to? Jimmy Page, right?
Yeah, Page, the Zeppelin. He actually collected all that stuff. And actually, he's connected to Crowley's connected through to the Manson family through Kenneth Anger.
Yeah.
Who lived with Bobby Bouzelet. So it's actually hard to believe. But Anger is a huge Crowley fan and former friends and now enemies with Jimmy Page. But there's references to Marilyn Manson. There's references to like artists like Alejandro Jodorowsky, the Beatles. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of a lesser guy who did well on Anger's thing, which is called Lucifer Rising. There's a guy, Donald Camel, is in that, who literally sat on Crowley's knee. He was literally a son of a friend of Crowley. And Crowley used to write him astrological things. His name's Donald Camel. I don't know if you've seen the film Performance, totally like satanic film.
Oh, no. I have to check that out.
Seeds through all you know, Leary, of course, Timothy Leary, who thought he was carrying on Crowley's work.
Now that you mentioned Jodorowsky, now I have to wonder what his version of Dune would be like. That's the thing right now, is to talk about Jodorowsky's Dune. With these kind of influences, I wonder what he would have done with Herbert's material.
Yeah, I don't think he would have been true to the book, which I think is unfortunate. Like, he was already kind of scheming and stuff. It would have been very strange and maybe interesting, like some of his other works, but I'm not sure he would have been true to what Herbert's.
Lookout Mountain, of course, is what we were talking about, I believe, with the
that's right.
Well, Lookout Mountain is now owned by Jared Leto. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's his uncle.
Yeah. And a really terrible band.
DE
Second. I hear he's an asshole too. This friend of mine, she's like obsessed with him.
Right?
She waited outside of his concert. He wouldn't even talk to her.
Really? Oh, wow. Yeah, he's probably the arrogant artiste, right?
Yeah.
So let's keep going down here. One project says Satanists can change. Well, yes, of course, anyone can change before they die, right?
Yeah.
Jodorowsky's Dune is called the Incal. The Incal? Or it's a graphic novel. Okay. Second, this is not in all caps, but I find that interesting. John Lennon produced a Jodorowsky movie. Don't think he was Thelemite. I don't know. I know there's the reference to Crowley on their album cover and stuff, but what was the influence of Crowley on the Beatles and specifically John Lennon?
Well, they thought they were kind of carrying on the magical tradition. And he said in one of his last interviews, John Lennon did, I think it was with Playboy, where he said, what the Beatles were about is doing what you want. And that's kind of Crowley's dictum, which is do what thou wilt. So he kind of, I think he intentionally aped that. And he was also, John Lennon was a very much, had an acrimonious outlook towards institutional Christianity, which Crowley would have shared. So I think they were both.
I don't hold that against them.
He said we're bigger than Jesus Christ. And he was kind of Lennon was kind of a pest to kind of American Christianity, is my understanding. A lot of the pastors didn't like him being around. But, you know, I think that he was a much nicer, Lennon was a much more kind and gentle guy than Crowley was,
for sure. Yeah, they say that there were people that were close to Lennon in the last 5 or so, 10 years or whatever of his life, who I remember about 10 or 12 years ago when the biography had come out about Lennon, it kind of made some, you know, folks of a political leaning clutch their pearls, because the sources said that as Lennon got older, he became more conservative. Now, not a flag-waving Republican, but he liked Ronald Reagan, for example, is what these people said. And he became more conservative as he got older. So that one, you know, for a lot of people was out of left field when you're talking about John Lennon.
Yeah, but, that's pretty strange.
Yeah, I don't hold it against anyone that has a trouble with institutional Christianity. I have trouble.
I don't either.
So it's like, okay.
I'm just saying.
That's a feather in his cap, you know. Are there, Nathan Etzel asks, are there any real Crowley connections to the Bush family? Well, there's that famous claim that he was Barbara Bush's father because of Cephalou and her mother and all that. Does anyone know more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's it was Pauline Pierce is Barbara Pierce slash Bush's mother, who was known to be in France. She was kind of like an elite scion here, where back in the time in the 20s with wealthy people who had money, they would go to Paris. Paris was not the dump that it is today. It was actually like the City of Lights. And that was a real attraction for wealthy people, artists, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had a friend who was O'Hara, and there was another guy, Harris, and then Harris was definitely good friends with Crowley. So it's rumored and alleged that Crowley was doing rituals at that time, and the offspring of Pauline, who doesn't really look like her other kids, is Barbara right. Bush. And the timing right. is kind of right. Her head's the same.
Crowley the timing's right. Big,
yeah.
They resent, you know. Head.
The genetics,
the, yeah, the resemblance, you know, of the features, the eyes, nose, and mouth.
It I mean, her relationship, you know, with Bush, it seems like an arranged marriage of right. two wealthy families, two kind of elite families, and then you can just lead up to the son to 9/11, which is just a full on magical yeah. working in the yeah. public.
Oh, yeah,
we're talking about this. Amy and I were actually talking about this on the phones. It's like you're telling me about like Bush going on and declaring it a new world order on at 9/11.
Right, was that 1990? So it's 11 years. It's 11 years to the date of September 11th, 2021.
Wow.
Yeah, Johnny Snyder says like,
it's either just one of the strangest coincidences in human history, or they had it all plotted out. Yeah. I'm thinking on those lines.
Yeah. We're gonna I haven't personally believed in coincidences in a long time. So
right.
you know. Johnny Side says Lenin was assassinated by an MK Ultra victim who, you know, yeah. Exactly. Well, there's the connections.
I would say he was an MK Ultra patsy. I don't think that actually Chapman shot him. Somebody else there was an assassin who came in. There's a book that just came out called Mind Games.
Yeah.
And they got the autopsy report, and the target, the shooting of Lenin, was what an assassin would do, which was at a tight spot on the left side of his chest where the blood comes out of the heart. So it's like, or goes in at one or the other. I forgot which one, but it basically would render your whole circulatory system, you know, gone. So
what was the caliber?
I don't remember offhand.
I wonder if it was a small caliber.
The story that Chapman went into the Dakota and shot him in that kind of entryway was all fake. It's not the real story because somehow Lenin's body got inside this kind of causeway that goes up a stairs to kind of like where the guard would be because there's a blood stain there. And then he came out. So there was something else going on. And Chapman was hanging around the Dakota. This is a fact. Hanging around the Dakota for months. Like he would hang out there and then leave. So it was almost like they were just getting him into place. And so I think he was a mind control patsy, not the actual killer. Much like Sirhan Sirhan. They couldn't leave it to choice and somebody who wasn't that trained. They just had to make sure that somebody thought and they thought they did it because they don't.
Yeah, that makes operational sense, you know, and I was thinking of the Amy, we stepped on you. You were saying something about, I think, Lenin and Crowley or.
Oh, I don't even remember.
I'm sorry.
Because they were bringing the people together.
They were. He like in his solo career. You know, he clearly, what you were saying earlier about how he switched directions. Well, maybe he wasn't ever really in that direction, or maybe he, like, during his solo career, it seems like during a lot of musicians' solo career, they change, like, a lot of what they supposedly represented, you know, when they were being controlled in a band or whatever. Then it's like their true feelings come out, and then they get rid of them because they realize, oh, shit, they're not easy to control and they're trying to do like the exact opposite of what we want. So, you know, he was trying to say, like, you know, like, we shouldn't be relying on the government. We should be relying on the people, you know? Right. And so,
right.
You know, yeah, that's no a major threat, especially when like a lot major
of that stuff, like the Beatles went from kind of lovey-dovey music to a very dark area and then broke off.
Yeah, right.
And Lennon comes on and starts singing anti-war songs and war, mm-hmm. like critic of the culture, like Working Class Hero is a brilliant song, man.
Yeah.
Working Class Hero. Which is a lot of truth, you know? So I think they could see why people would think that this guy's too independent. And it's just intro to Parallax Views where, hey, I'm a politician. They say I'm independent, too independent for my own good.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Bang, bang. That's an interesting movie, folks, if you haven't seen the Parallax View.
But it ties into all these other, like Chapman.
Yes, it does.
I think it actually hints at it. I think Parallax View was made before the Chapman event.
Do you, any of you, this is for all three of you, do you think that the reemergence of the Doors' popularity was merely driven by the film or just the nostalgia because that generation was then, you know, they were coming into their, you know, upper middle age and retirement. Do you think it was just nostalgia driven, or do you think that maybe they wanted to reinvigorate any of the social influence?
I think a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm. Because it was the years leading up to 9/11, which William was just, pointing
around,
out.
Around that same time, the Beatles released Free as a Bird, too, which is like the first sort of I guess it's sort of the first put your foot in the water type of thing with like AI, right? Because it had sort of Lennon's lyrics in there,
mm-hmm.
right? And they kind of placed his vocals in there and everything like that. It's sort of a really interesting song. I don't know if you've ever heard it.
I think I have.
Released once. In like the very like 99, 2000, that sort of area.
Well, I could see where nostalgia could be a psyop weapon. If you want to freeze up people's ability to think clearly and act on a political motivation or you know, show any kind of resistance, entrap them, ensnare them in nostalgia so that they calm down and they get wrapped up for a time in, oh, remember when, so that they don't focus too much on what's going on in the here and now. And
that's what they're doing now on social media. That's like all they're doing. I've noticed that. Right? People are just whining about, it's not as good as it used to be. And I'm like, dude, in a way.
And every generation says that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they came out with a Woodstock movie recently. I don't know if y'all remember that. That was like a couple years ago. And I remember my parents talking, my parents are boomers. So they couldn't stop talking about it. I was like, yeah, they're trapping you. They'll never see it, but they'll never see they're being trapped. But
right. Eugene Levy was in that movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Interesting that in the film, the great film, the 1971 Omega Man with Charlton Heston, great B film, of course. The movie, it's a post-pandemic, right, dystopian story. And the movie that he goes to the movie theater to screen and watch over and over again is the original film about Woodstock. And, you know, think of the message of that. Here we have a story. It's just 1971 when this movie comes out. And I think it's further emphasizing the killing of the hippie love era because you're showing post Manson, you're showing this post pandemic, people have been wiped out, dystopian film. And the movie he's watching, the fact that they juxtapose that with showing Woodstock, I think the unspoken message there is see where it led to. It led to dystopia and everybody dying.
Right.
I think that's the subconscious message of Woodstock being the film that he watches in the Omega Man.
That's really interesting. You know, the whole thing with the hippie movement and like Woodstock and all that, there's a real dark side to the hippie movement, right? It's this idea, and it goes back to Crowley, right? Freedom, mm-hmm. the whole idea of total freedom. And you started, like, the hippies started feeling entitled that, like, we need to be here. We shouldn't have to pay for this, right? Any goods and services we shouldn't have to pay for. And, like, I remember there was around 1974, I want to say, in London, there was a festival that was sort of Woodstock-esque, had a lot of bands from that era. It got really freaking violent. Like, you really got to see, like, the dark side of hippiedom. Like, it was on display because it all was captured on tape.
Human nature, you know. Yeah. Anytime you get that many people together, you know.
Human nurture.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. True. Sorry, I had to interject.
I like that. But yeah, you know, you get a bunch of people together, and you get them, you know, loosening up with, with music and either alcohol or drugs. you're gonna have, you know, people running into each other, you know, and some bad things happening. Oregon Music Fam points out that, you know, Altamont, of course, the final nail in the coffin.
Right. And I think we're going to probably end up doing a show on Altamont because there's some really interesting stuff with Altamont.
Leary,
Melvin Belli, the Rolling Stones.
There's a lot out there. Yep. Well, folks, we're here at the hour and a half point, and that's usually where we bring this to an end and for the episode. And I want to thank Amy and William for joining Todd and I this episode. And I think this was one of the more interesting discussions we've ever had on this channel.
Yeah.
And we've just started, really. I can see us revisiting this topic or facets of it again. So I hope you guys would be willing to do that.
Absolutely.
So. Yeah. And I mean, this felt like a really smooth conversation. And I just want to remind everybody, you know, you may not agree with us about the like Jim Morrison and Aleister Crowley and stuff. It's okay to disagree. So, you know, it's all right. There's no stigma. We are not above you in any way or anything like that. This is just a fun discussion.
Yeah. And you know, I'm still in the process of the extent to which I studied Crowley was for my Empire of the Wheel books. That's what initially had me look at Crowley. And within the context of what I was writing about there, I found nothing to the extent that I had to look at Crowley, I found nothing to convince me of a lot of these dark, awful things that I often hear about him. And Todd knows that, William knows that. But my thing is, I can't wait to read William's book, Child of the Beast. And, you know, because there might be some things I'm just not aware of that convince me otherwise. You know, I'm kind of ambivalent about Crowley. He could be kind of a weird guy, and there's things he did and was into that I have no interest in. But, you know, so just to further emphasize what Todd was saying is, you know, between us here, we have differences, you know, a spectrum of opinion on him. And with Morrison, you know, I see Morrison as a guy who, you know, was, you know, the voracious reader, a scholar, you know, kind of expressing himself like young people do in sometimes an awkward, sometimes very embarrassing, negative ways. I don't see him as an occultist per se, but then again, I'm not as familiar with all the data yet as you guys are. So again, Todd, thanks for bringing that up, because we hear, you know, even though we don't agree on the degree of everything, we have the discussion, and that's what, you know, that's what this is about. So, and someone said in the comments, despite all this, I mean, I still listen to my Doors' greatest hits. It's great. You know, it's good music.
I still listen to the Grateful Dead.
Mm-hmm.
right?
You know,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, they make good music.
It's good music. Ripple's fantastic.
Doesn't matter if they were like worshiping Satan. Like, you can still enjoy the music.
Yeah.
So there we go. So anyway, I want to thank everybody in the live chat. Of course, you guys are great. I want to thank everybody watching. And if there were any newbies out there, please,
and subscribe.
Yeah, like and subscribe and keep coming back. And we will we'll all see you next month with another great episode of Killifornia. So
bye.
Thanks.